Good morning, and welcome to our weekly series for the Virginia Mason Primary Care Curriculum. And today we are going to be talking about leukopenia and thrombocytopenia. My name is Ananth Shenoy. I'm an outpatient internist and former member of the Virginia Mason Primary Care Team. And I'm joined today by your wonderful faculty member, Dr. Madhani Mohanachandran. I'll let her say hi.
Hi.
Good morning. We are going to tackle a couple of complex topics that come up pretty frequently and thankfully usually are not concerning, usually have relatively benign etiologies, but we need to know how to do that workup. So we're going to be talking first about neutropenia, and then we're going to be talking about thrombocytopenia. And we're going to review the differentials and understand kind of the benign presentations as well as when we need to look for the not so benign presentations. Dr. Mohan, I think you have a couple of updates for us on healthcare disparities as it relates to these topics.
Right. So very common healthcare disparity regarding neutropenia and leukopenia and thrombocytopenia is that we base our normal neutrophil counts on a Caucasian and Asian descent population. And so that is what usually will look normal. So many people with African and Middle Eastern ancestry will have inherited variants that will lead to lower counts against that normal standard. So in the United States, an NHANES study shows that 4.5% of Black Americans met criteria for neutropenia compared to 0.79% of white Americans and 0.38% of Mexican Americans. However, the other big thing for us to keep in mind is that it's important not to just assume a person's neutropenia is due to this normal genetic variation. We still need to be thinking of what is the basic history, what is the basic workup that should be warranted when we see this in the clinic.
Well said. And I think this is, again, just a common thread that we've seen time and time again when talking about these topics in terms of the population that was studied and just the default assumptions, which do not usually apply to all of our patients. Mm-hmm. So with that, Dr. Mohan, is it okay if I give you a couple cases and you walk us through how you would approach them?
Sure.
All right. So case one, we have Mr. Apple. And Mr. Apple is a 47-year-old gentleman with a past medical history notable for hypertension, hyperlipidemia, depression, and obesity, our wheelhouse issues, and who comes in today for a routine health visit. No concerns, and is taking medications as prescribed, which are hydrochlorothiazide, atorvastatin, and sertraline. The vitals are pretty unremarkable. And labs, though, which we get because we're just being thoughtful, diligent internists, we get a complete blood count. The white blood cells come back at 3.2, which, just as a reminder, like normal is 4.5 to about 11. The hemoglobin is normal at 13.8. The platelets are also normal at 322. And when we look at a differential for that white blood cell count, we get neutrophils of 35%, which is a little low, and then lymphocytes of 62%, which is a little high. My first question for you, Dr. Mohan, is what is the differential of this leukocytosis on this blood count and this overall lymphocytosis with this leukopenia? And how do you determine the absolute lymphocyte and neutrophil counts from this differential?
Yes, so the differential is the percentage of different types of leukocytes within the total white blood cell count. And it usually will include neutrophils, which should be 40 to 70% of the white blood cell counts, lymphocytes, which are usually 20 to 40% of the total white blood cell counts, eosinophils, basophils, and monocytes. And if you're trying to figure out absolute counts, you want to do your white blood cell count times percentage divided by 100. And as a reminder, for your percentage neutrophils, you always want to make sure you're also including your percentage bands as well. However, when we're actually determining abnormality, we don't use the relative percentages. We're actually using the absolute counts.
That's a really good reminder. And another reminder, which I should have mentioned earlier, is that while I'm giving you patient cases, these are all fictional cases and there is no protected health information involved. So my next question for you, how do you define leukopenia, lymphocytopenia, and neutropenia? And in this case, what is Mr. Apple's absolute neutrophil count?
So leukopenia is an absolute white blood cell count of less than 4,500 over microliters, or the individual lab's lower limit of normal. Lymphocytopenia, also known as lymphopenia, is when the absolute lymphocyte count is less than 1,000. And then neutropenia is an absolute neutrophil count, or ANC, of less than 1,500. It's mild if you're 1,000 to 1,500, moderate if it's 500 to 1,000, and it's severe if it's less than 500. And then we call it agranulocytosis if it's less than 200. In this case, Mr. Apple's ANC is 1.12, so he's in more of that mild range.
I think the math that Dr. Mohan did is she took the total white blood cell count and multiplied it by the percent. And I think usually we don't have to do these numbers, but occasionally they'll just give you, the lab will usually report the percents. And so it is nice if you need to convert them, particularly when you are more worried with those inpatients who are really sick and who are getting chemotherapy, and you really want to know that absolute neutrophil count. Now, Dr. Mohan, I'm going to have you go back to medical school, and I want you to describe to our listeners kind of how are neutrophils produced and what is their typical life cycle?
All right, let's see if I can still pronounce these words. So when you're within the bone marrow, you start as that hematopoietic stem cell, then you become a myeloblast, then a promyelocyte, then a myelocyte, then a metamyelocyte, then a band cell, and then a segmented polyneutrophil, which we also call PMNs. These are helpful to know because sometimes you will see all of them on your differential when you are looking at your labs. The mature neutrophils are going to travel to the blood plasma, and the total blood pool of neutrophils is the neutrophils circulating in the plasma, which is the circulating pool. And then you have neutrophils that are just rolling along the endothelial surfaces of small vessels, like little tumbleweeds that are the marginated pool. And there is free exchange of neutrophils between the circulating and marginated pools. The neutrophils will shift, though, from the marginated pool to the circulating pool after there's been exposure to epinephrine, stress, steroids especially, or exercise. And then neutrophils in the blood pool will migrate to the tissues, and once they do that, they don't normally return to the blood. So having increased neutrophil migration to the tissue will basically occur and be an indication that there's ongoing inflammation. Eventually, like all cells though, neutrophils are going to undergo apoptosis, and they'll be removed from the tissues through phagocytosis by macrophages, and the rate of apoptosis is affected by inflammatory cytokines and chemokines.
That was very impressive, Dr. Mohan. Way to go back through all of that stuff from like intro path and intro heme. Now that we know about the life cycle, my next question for you is, what are the pathways that can lead to neutropenias? And then what are the most common clinical causes of said neutropenia?
All right. So first off, there's decreased production of mature neutrophils in the bone marrow. So you can have a primary hematologic disorder that affects the bone marrow, like myelodysplastic syndrome, acute myeloid leukemia, multiple myeloma. You can have acquired bone marrow suppression, alcohol being the biggest culprit, but then also chemotherapy and radiation, direct infiltration of the bone marrow by non-hematologic malignancies, nutritional deficiencies like B12, folate, copper, if you have severe protein calorie deficits, infection of the main hematopoietic precursor cells like infectious mononucleosis, acute hep A, chronic hep B and C, and then HIV. And then there's also congenital deficiencies. Then the other way that you can get neutropenia is through increased destruction. And that's usually going to be by the immune system through like a transfusion reaction or autoimmune conditions like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, which can cause something called Felty syndrome. Then the final way is doing increased redistribution of the neutrophils to the vascular endothelium through margination, the spleen, or in tissues. So infections can lead to increased adherence of the neutrophils to endothelium. So dengue, measles, rickettsia, some bacterial infections will do it. And also increase the utilization of neutrophils at the site of the infection. And then splenic sequestration is the other way, which you can see with portal hypertension.
So again, we're breaking that down by either we don't produce as many, or we are consuming them, or they're just in a different space, usually doing work for us. That's great. So we've talked about kind of the life cycle. How are the lymphocytes produced?
So within the bone marrow, the hematopoietic stem cells, our usual base cell, is then going to become lymphocytes. 75% of them will travel to the thymus and become T cells, and then 25% are going to stay in the bone marrow and they're going to become B cells. So your total lymphocyte pool is what you've got in the blood, what you have in the lymphoid tissues, which are your lymph nodes and spleen, and then what you have in the non-lymphoid tissue, like the lungs and liver.
Yeah, this is going way back to first year of medical school and those differences between neutrophils and those lymphocytes. So now that we've already talked about other things that can affect things like the neutrophils, what are the main pathways that can lead to a deficiency in lymphocytes or lymphocytopenia?
So here we have two options. You either decrease the production or you increase the destruction. And so your primary options are going to be infections like HIV, flu, COVID, bacterial, fungal, parasitic infections, medications like chemotherapy agents or anti-B or T-cell therapies, or you can have an inherited immunodeficiency disorder such as severe combined immunodeficiency.
And these are, of course, many conditions we're very familiar with. And as you point out, sometimes our very medications can be the cause of deficiencies. And while we're not often prescribing those anti-B and T-cell therapies, we're often seeing our patients in clinic. And it is really helpful to know how those drugs work in order to be thinking about that, because we might be the first ones to notice the lymphocytopenia. Now, so we're talking about, in this case, a neutropenia. How should you evaluate that? Like for Mr. Apple, and what are red flag findings in history and labs that signal that this is something more urgent that needs a higher level workup?
Right, so starting off with your evaluation. So on history and exam, check, are the vital signs unstable? Are there signs and symptoms of an infection? Any new medications, history of chemotherapy or radiation recently? Are they having any constitutional symptoms? Also check if they've got a history of recurrent infections, because neutropenia does predispose you more to cellulitis, sinusitis, otitis, pharyngitis, pneumonia, and perirectal infections. And then for physical exam findings, look in the mouth and skin for findings of infection. Look for stigmata of liver disease, Then also you look for things like joint swelling if you're thinking autoimmune, and then lymphadenopathy and splenomegaly. Then go and take a look at the lab. So review the prior CBC. Is this neutropenia new? Chronic neutropenia is around for 3 months or more, whereas a transient neutropenia is usually going to be related to viral infections. If it's new and unexpected, you should probably repeat a CBC to ensure the accuracy. Then the next thing to look at is the neutropenia isolated or are multiple cells affected? Is there anemia, thrombocytopenia? Is this like a full pancytopenia? If there is severe neutropenia, it's usually going to be medication-induced. Pancytopenia should make you think about a hematologic malignancy, bone marrow failure, and sometimes like a rheumatologic disease like lupus. And then if you're seeing neutropenia with a megaloblastic anemia, then you should be thinking about a nutritional deficiency. Then the next thing to take a look at is what is the ANC? As we had discussed, we have those different thresholds of degree of neutropenia. And then also get a peripheral blood smear. So that's going to help you rule out a hematologic emergencies. If you see blasts like an AML, it can point to an underlying disease process like hypersegmented PMNs and B12 deficiency. And then in addition to that, other labs for you to check are HIV and viral hepatitis serologies. Check their LFTs, check B12, folate, and copper. And you can consider ESR and CRP to identify systemic inflammation. Physical exam findings may be less apparent in the setting of neutropenia, so this might be more of your indication of how to figure out that something is going on. And then only if clinical features are present for rheumatologic disease, in that case, check an ANA, rheumatoid factor, and anti-CCP. And then after all of that, if you're still really not sure, obtain a bone marrow biopsy. And that is what we would do for unexplained chronic neutropenia that is not clearly due to a Duffy null associated neutrophil count, which we're going to talk about in a second. In thinking about, you've done all of this workup, who is the person I should be monitoring? Who is the person I should be worried about? For monitoring, if it's a new neutropenia, it's a mild infection, and the ANC is above 1500, it's probably transient neutropenia. You just reevaluate the CBC after the infection has resolved. If they're asymptomatic, there is a neutropenia with an ANC like 500 to 1000, but the blood smear is generally reassuring. Repeat again in 1 to 2 weeks. Refer to hemonc if it's persistent and just not responding to what you think the cause might be. And then asymptomatic patients with an ANC greater than 1000, reassuring blood smear. Once again, just repeat the CBC. 2 to 6 weeks is a reasonable time frame, and then refer to hemonc if it's still persisting. If they're asymptomatic, have a low white blood cell count present for months to years, they probably don't need a hemonc evaluation. Because, you know, mild neutropenia could be caused by rheumatologic disease. If they have portal hypertension or cirrhosis, they could be having hypersplenism. And then, of course, there's a Duffy null associated neutrophil count, which we will discuss. The people you should be panicking about, basically, and thinking like, okay, you need to go to the hospital or I need to page hemonc if they're at least asymptomatic, is if their vital signs are unstable, if you're seeing worrisome signs on the peripheral smear like blasts or schistocytes, and ANC less than 500, because that's going to greatly increase susceptibility to bacterial and fungal infections, especially if they have agranulocytosis where they're less than 200, because that's life-threatening and is usually going to be caused by medications. And since it's immune-mediated, it's very unpredictable. If it's an ANC less than 1500 and they're having fevers or concerns for severe infection, or you think something's going on that's a primary bone marrow disorder, that's a person that needs to be going to the hospital or at least discuss with hemonc.
That is very comprehensive. Thank you, Dr. Mohan. So we're thinking about our workup, thinking about really being strategic and looking for like signs and symptoms of constitutional or other systemic diseases. And of course, that instability or a really low count that should trigger something more urgent in our workup. And you keep promising that you're going to talk to us about the Duffy null associated neutrophil count, which is very important because that's going to be the benign cause. That's probably the most common reason. So getting back to our case, when you review Mr. Apple's labs for the past 20 years, it looks like he's been neutropenic for a long time, this very mild neutropenia. And so in this case, you suspect this patient has a Duffy null associated neutrophil count, or DANC. Now, I will tell you, of course, I have been out of medical school for a while. When I was in medical school, we did not call it Duffy null associated neutrophil or neutrophilia or neutrophil count. So what is the Duffy null associated neutrophil count?
So this is what they used to call benign ethnic neutropenia. Duffy null is clearly a much more accurate name, I would say. It's an inherited cause for ANC counts that can be between 500 to 1500, but usually it will run above 1200. And it's due to polymorphism that results in the absence of a Duffy antigen expression on red blood cells, which is felt to be protective against malaria. So we tend to see it in some people of African and Middle Eastern Mediterranean descent. But it's not associated with like recurrent or unusual infections, other cytopenias, physical findings, or other causes of cytopenias. It's very benign. And so in a person with persistent and stable mild neutropenia who is of African Middle Eastern ancestry and has otherwise had a normal initial evaluation, so you need to remember to do that evaluation still, does not need to do further workup. So at that point, then you just assume that that's what's going on. You don't have to type for Duffy antigen. You don't have to do genetic testing or a bone marrow biopsy, but you still have to do that initial workup that we just talked about.
That's great. So reviewing why the nomenclature has changed and recognizing that if you have a pattern that fits with this and a patient where that makes sense and you've done the initial screening and made sure that there's not some severe systemic illness, you don't have to go forward with the bone marrow biopsy, which really helps cut down on all those procedures we put people through and just the misery of bone marrow biopsies. So that was a very helpful review, thinking about leukopenia and neutropenia and just lymphocytopenias, and of course the really common Duffy null associated low neutrophil count. We're going to go ahead and transition, so I'm going to give you another case to emphasize some other teaching points, and then we're going to talk a little bit about platelets. Hooray! So, case two, we have Mr. K. And Mr. K is a 57-year-old gentleman with a past medical history of hypertension, alcohol use disorder, and obesity. He was unfortunately recently admitted to the hospital for acute alcohol intoxication and withdrawal. It's interesting that he was admitted for acute intoxication, and I'm guessing then he withdrew while he was in the hospital.
That makes the most logical sense.
Yeah.
Happens in the ED. Makes sense.
You couldn't be intoxicated and withdrawing at the same time. That would be impressive. Anyways, sorry, getting back to the case. You are seeing him in clinic for a hospital discharge follow-up, and he has remained abstinent from alcohol since the time of his discharge. Hooray! His vital signs are reassuring in clinic, and you review the most recent labs from the hospitalization. And I'll just read you some of these, Dr. Mohan. So, the AST and ALT were elevated. They are now downtrending. The AST is cut in half, although it's still elevated at 160. The white blood cell count was low in the hospital at 3.2. It's now a little bit higher at 4.3. And recall, we had discussed that depending on the lab, the normal range might be 4.5 to 11, or again, it can vary a little bit depending on your lab's reference. The hemoglobin count was also low at 9.7 in the hospital. It's improved, but it's still low at 10.9. And the platelet count was fairly low at 72 and is now improved to 125, which is a reminder for everyone that's still low, normal low, kind of the low part of normal is 150. So still on the low side. So I'm now going to ask you once again to go back to medical school, and I would like you to walk me through the life cycle of platelets and how they are stored.
Right, round two. Okay, so in the bone marrow, back to hematopoietic stem cells, and now they're going to become megakaryocytes, and then a protoplatelet, and then this will separate to several thousand platelets, and this is regulated by thrombopoietin, or TPO, which will bind onto receptors on platelets and MK cells, and which are the megakaryocyte cells, and so basically prevents apoptosis, so you can make more megakaryocytes. And TPO is made by the liver and kidney, which is important. So when the platelet counts are low, the liver is supposed to make more TPO, which makes more megakaryocytes, which then makes more platelets. And then when the platelet counts are normal, then the TPO basically will bind on to the platelets and basically just try to stabilize them and maintain homeostasis, the MK cells and the platelet production. And usually a third of your platelets are in your spleen and two-thirds are out in circulation. Then, of course, the senescent platelets that are of less use, they are removed by circulation, by monocytes and macrophages. So usually after like 5 to 10 days, and this is usually happening in the reticular endothelial system, so inside of the liver and the spleen.
That's a really helpful review, and thankfully a lot simpler than when we went through with the white blood cells. So what is thrombocytopenia?
So thrombocytopenia is a platelet count of less than 150, and once again, we've got this categorized. So mild is 100 to 150, moderate is 50 to 100, and then severe is less than 50.
And what are the main mechanisms that cause thrombocytopenia?
So you basically have four options. So one is decreased production. So medications, alcohol, myelodysplastic syndromes, liver disease, and nutritional deficiencies would be the cause there. You've got redistribution or hypersplenism. So lymphoproliferative disorders, portal hypertension from fibrosis and liver cirrhosis would be the cause in that one. Then you have increased destruction or consumption of platelets. So premature removal from immune complexes. So this is what we're thinking about, like ITP. And then also thrombosis. So like HIT, DIC, HUS, the thrombotic microangiopathic syndromes all kind of fall under this category. Then there's, of course, dilution. So fluid resuscitation, gestational thrombocytopenia, postoperative thrombocytopenia usually are from that. And then, of course, there is pseudothrombocytopenia, which is just artificial low platelet counts because the platelets all clumped because of EDTA. And that's going to be diagnosed on smear. And some poor lab tech is going to be counting your platelets to give you the answer there, or they'll ask you to repeat the CBC.
Yes, which is a really good reminder because that happens not infrequently, both in the hospital and in clinic. So it's really helpful to, again, we're thinking about, are we not producing as much, or are they sequestered somewhere, or are they being destroyed or diluted? And I think just another helpful reminder, which thankfully we don't ever deal with in clinic, but one of those increased consumptions is if people are bleeding very rapidly and bleeding so fast that they can't keep up with their platelet production. Although I don't think I've seen that since medical school and on the trauma service. So what are some symptoms of thrombocytopenia, Dr. Mohan?
So that's going to be decreased clotting ability, which will increase bleeding. So look for petechiae, bruising, and mucosal bleeding. Acute thrombocytopenia can be due to conditions, though, that are causing excessive clotting. So essentially consumption of the platelets. So that would be our other option.
So this is not an infrequent concern. I think probably at least once a month, a patient brings up increased bleeding or bruising in clinic. So what is the relationship between thrombocytopenia and liver disease, particularly thinking about our patient, Mr. K? And then next question, what is the likely explanation of this patient's platelet abnormalities, that thrombocytopenia? And of course, does he need additional evaluation?
Of course, the most important question. So thrombocytopenia, it's seen in 64 to 84% of patients with liver cirrhosis. And liver dysfunction basically reduces production of hepatic TPO. And then you also have portal hypertension, which leads to hypersplenism. So you're sequestering platelets, which will also decrease the TPO. And mainly in patients with liver disease, they also have other conditions that cause thrombocytopenia. So if you think about it, alcohol is directly toxic to bone marrow. And so that's going to reduce lifespan of the platelet. It's going to reduce liver production of TPO. There's often also malnutrition by itself that can cause it. And then also viral hepatitis might be another cause. So in his case, his alcohol could account for all of his cytopenias, but he also needs to be evaluated for chronic liver disease and malnutrition. So in him, we would obtain a liver ultrasound and assess liver parenchyma and spleen size. You want to check his B12, folate, and thiamine levels, and then very strongly advise cessation of alcohol because this should lead to normalization of platelets within a few weeks if there aren't other comorbidities that are causing this patient's thrombocytopenia. And I'm going to share a tangent aside that was provided by Dr. Cunningham, who was the one who had written this didactic, where she shares a lesson that she learned the hard way, where thrombocytopenia can be the first presenting finding of cirrhosis. So really make a habit of calculating a FIB-4 score once yearly on all your patients with diabetes, prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, and obesity, just trying to catch anybody who's at higher risk. And also keep in mind that patients can still be developing advanced liver disease from MASLD, even with liver labs that are flagged as normal. So a key point, normal ranges of ALT and AST in Cerner in our system actually underestimate the true prevalence of liver inflammation. So ALT and AST levels greater than 40 are not actually truly normal, according to the American College of Gastroenterology.
That's a really helpful reminder. And I think just a good warning for all of us, that it can be very easy to see, oh, the platelets are just a little bit low. Oh, they're usually a little bit low. That's just a lab abnormality that somebody else can deal with. And as a reminder, in primary care, that other person is us. It's our job to work those things up as really good internists. So Dr. Mohan, I'm going to give you another case if that's okay. So our next case, Mr. M is a 65-year-old gentleman with a past medical history of coronary artery disease who's had a PCI, also hypertension and hyperlipidemia, probably why they have coronary disease. His previous PCP unfortunately retired, and he is new to your practice. He has no active concerns, though, somehow on today's visit. Small miracle. His medications include aspirin, metoprolol, lisinopril, and atorvastatin. You, being the diligent internist you are, review his blood work that was done prior to the visit and note his complete blood cell count results. So the white blood cells are 6.8, so within that nice normal range. The hemoglobin is 13.2, then a normal range. Hematocrit, again, 42%, as it should be in a normal range, given what I already told you. But the platelets are 89, which, as a reminder, normal range usually 150 and above. And the creatinine, electrolytes, and liver function testing are all reassuringly within normal limits. You bring up to him that his platelet count is a little bit low. He thinks that he's overheard something about this before from maybe one of his other doctors, but he's not really sure. It's a really long word, thrombocytopenia. Who remembers this? So your dilemma is, or my dilemma for you, is how do you determine the urgency in working up this platelet count of 89?
Right. So first, consider and look at that CBC. So repeat the CBC if results are unexpected to ensure accuracy. Obtain a peripheral smear. Think about, could this be pseudothrombocytopenia? Take a look at the other cell lines, see if they're affected. Figure out if the thrombocytopenia is chronic, and then think about how severe is the thrombocytopenia. So if the platelet count is less than 50, you really should be thinking about sending them to the ED, or at the very least paging hemonc. If the platelets are less than 10, they're at high risk of spontaneous severe bleeding that is going to the ED. Then take a look at the history. So is there a recent illness or hospitalization? Were they exposed to heparin products? Are there any new medications? Most commonly antibiotics, anti-epileptic drugs, chemotherapy, sulfa drugs, some of the antipsychotic medications, quinones, NSAIDs, antihistamines, and spironolactone actually all can cause thrombocytopenia. It is very helpful to just up-to-date this if you have a question. Except for HIT, most of the drug-induced thrombocytopenias, though, will resolve with removal of the offending agent after 7 to 10 days. The other thing to think about is, are they pregnant? So then after that, physical exam. Do they have current bleeding or bruising? Is there acute swelling? Like, is there any signs that they might be having a clot? Do they have a new neurologic symptom? So should you be thinking about like HUS-TTP? Really, the most life-threatening causes of thrombocytopenia are going to be the thrombotic microangiopathic conditions, including hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS, disseminated intravascular coagulation, DIC, and then thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, TTP. But they are also usually going to be associated with systemic illness, bleeding, and thrombosis complications. Then, of course, you've got heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, and then you've got the HELLP syndrome in pregnancy.
That's a very, very helpful differential to review and a good reminder for all of us, things that we're going to be thinking about here. So in this case, again, we're examining Mr. M. Thankfully, he has stable vital signs and no stigmata of bleeding or clotting, and amazingly, no new contributory medications, and interestingly, has had normal white blood cell counts, hemoglobin, and liver and renal functions as you look back. So you're considering your next steps. You do believe he warrants an outpatient evaluation, given that he's got moderate thrombocytopenia here. So in this case, which again, we don't think it's urgent, but we do need outpatient workup, what are the next steps you're going to take? What labs and what other tests?
So for a person with platelet counts less than 100,000, you should check a CBC again, check a CMR to get a sense of their kidney and liver function, check COAG studies, so PT, INR, check B12, folate, HIV, hepatitis B, and C serologies, and then our peripheral blood smear. And what you're looking for on that blood smear is platelet clumping to think pseudothrombocytopenia, schistocytes, which should make you think about the TMAs, giant platelets, which should make you think about ITP or congenital thrombocytopenia, and then also it will give you a sense of if the immature platelet fraction is elevated, which is going to indicate that the bone marrow is adequately producing platelets, or if it is low, which would indicate that there's primary bone marrow failure. Then, of course, do an abdominal ultrasound, look for liver disease, portal hypertension, hypersplenism. If there's concomitant anemia, then test hemolysis in addition with LDH, haptoglobin, and Coombs testing. And then really, bone marrow evaluation is going to be reserved only if multiple cell lines are affected.
So that's great. So we have an outline of the steps we're going to take and really exploring that differential, as you mentioned, and also thinking about the history that'll guide us there. So you proceed with this outpatient workup, and the first step is you recheck again in about 6 weeks, and his platelets remain in a similar range, but no other abnormalities are noted. The other labs that you wanted to get, things like the checking again, renal function, liver function, you check the B12, the folate, HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C, all of which are reassuringly normal and negative. Confirm on history that he has no history of liver disease and he does not drink alcohol. Super important question. So you suspect he may have an immune thrombocytopenia, ITP. And so when should we suspect ITP, and how do we go about diagnosing it? Because this is always confusing. And do all patients with ITP need treatment?
So ITP develops because of antibodies that develop against platelet membrane glycoproteins, which then increases splenic destruction of platelets. Causes include autoimmune syndromes like lupus, infections, medications, lymphoid malignancies, immunodeficiency syndromes, and infection. There's no definitive test for ITP. It's really a diagnosis of exclusion for a patient where we don't have a better explanation for their chronic thrombocytopenia. It may lead to increased bleeding, especially if the platelet count is less than 20, easy bruising, and fatigue. And severe thrombocytopenia due to ITP is generally managed by hematologists, usually with steroids and IVIG. For people with platelets who are running above 50K, it is usually monitored, but the frequency of recommendation is not standardized. So special counseling consideration does need to be made with patients undergoing surgery or who are pregnant. And antiplatelets, anticoagulates should not be held for mild to moderate thrombocytopenia. Sorry, my brain had a little break. For patients with severe thrombocytopenia, avoid high-risk sports like rugby. And of course, counsel patients to limit alcohol. I guess they should also avoid like football and all those other.
Yeah, that was a particular call out of rugby, which I don't know how much rugby we get in in the Pacific Northwest. But yes, and things like downhill skiing, right? Yeah. That's a particularly high risk event. So when should an outpatient who has thrombocytopenia be referred to a hematologist for like the more aggressive workup?
So if you've got a chronic platelet count less than 100, when the etiology is not apparent, if they've got severe thrombocytopenia, when there's a concern for a lymphoproliferative disorder or myelodysplastic syndrome, and then of course after an initial diagnosis of ITP, many patients with ITP can be monitored by primary care, or you can refer to a hematologist if the platelet count is less than 50K, if there's a bleeding concern, if there's a planned surgery, or if there's pregnancy.
That's great. So when we're thinking about thrombocytopenia, we're looking at the severity of it, and then we're going through our differential, starting with, is this increased destruction or decreased production or is sequestration? And then we're kind of working through, based on our suspicion, kind of checking for the common things, looking for those different systemic illnesses and viruses that can cause it, looking at offending medications, which your list was like basically all the medications we prescribe, and then thinking about the acuity of it and the chronicity. With that, Dr. Mohan, I'm going to give you just a couple of other quick questions, which are just knowledge questions and mix-up questions. So question number one, which class of medication is not typically associated with thrombocytopenia? Is it antiepileptics, antipsychotics, antivirals, or antibiotics?
Antivirals, but antibiotics, antiepileptics, and antipsychotic medications definitely are associated with thrombocytopenia. So those ones you do need to think about.
I can't even recall how many cases of thrombocytopenia I caused in the hospital with antibiotics. Okay, question two. ITP requires a bone marrow evaluation to confirm diagnosis. Is this true or false?
False. So patients with suspected mild ITP and platelet counts greater than 50K do not require bone marrow biopsy for diagnosis. So just as a reminder, it's a diagnosis of exclusion.
That's great. Next question, I think it'll be the last question before I let you go. Which of the following is consistent with Duffy null associated neutropenia? Is it anemia, splenomegaly, recurrent infections, or no need for bone marrow evaluation to make the diagnosis?
So D. Duffy null associated neutropenia is a benign condition. Patients do not have other cytopenia, splenomegaly, or recurrent infections. You don't need a bone marrow evaluation to diagnose this.
Very helpful reminder. Again, this is a benign condition. You do need to do your workup, and you don't need to do things like bone marrow biopsies or the genotyping. If the history is consistent and they are not at a greater risk of things like infections, which is great news. So with that, Dr. Mohan, I want to thank you for being our expert and walking us through both neutropenias and, of course, leukopenias and then thrombocytopenias. And I want to acknowledge Dr. Erica Cunningham, another one of the wonderful members of the faculty who put together this great didactic for us. And I want to welcome everyone back next week when we will be covering yet another exciting topic from the world of internal medicine. Anything else you want to say, Dr. Mohan?
Nope, I think you covered it all.
Excellent. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.